Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
So, a physicist, a philosopher, and a psychologist walk into a bar. Actually, no, they walk into a classroom. Three big-time profs teach this course at UC Berkeley on how to make better decisions in life, using the tools that scientists keep in their pockets. They call it Sense and Sensibility and Science, rather catchy. And now they have a book out. It's called Third Millennium Thinking. The authors are John Campbell, Robert McCohen, and the person who joins us now, Nobel physicist Saul Perlmutter. Professor Saul, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
It seems clear that you and your co-authors want this to be a practical book, or for people to have tools to make informed decisions about, should I or my child go into big time debt to pay for college? You know, should I add more protein to my diet? Should my county make it easier to build multifamily buildings rather than single family houses? Those happen to be things that I'm actually thinking about myself, real questions in my mind. And so first to ask you, Professor, what do you suggest as a starting point to think about all of these things in our lives?
I think that what really motivated us when we got started on this was the realization that there is so much of what is the scientific approach to the world that is never taught anywhere. As far as we knew, we take courses perhaps in a single physics, biology, chemistry, mm-hmm. but they never really get at how is it that we've learned all the things that we've learned. And they turn out to be great things to approach our world, both for all those practical questions that you just raised, but also bigger pictures of how our society can work with each other to solve big problems. So on both scales, it seemed like this was a time for us to be trying to figure out how can we teach this in ways that don't require having to become a scientist in order to do it.
Yeah, no, as you're talking about, I feel daunted myself. I'm speaking to a Nobel physicist. I ditched chemistry in the 10th grade. It's been a long time. So for the rest of us, what should we know about the scientific method and how it applies to all of these day-to-day decisions?
Scientists have over many, many years realized that we tend to fool ourselves, that there's so many things that we just get wrong that we have to be constantly trying to develop techniques to be able to tell when we're going off the rails. And so much of what we began teaching in this course were just some of the different ways in which we will fall into these mental traps, we'll get things wrong, and being perfectly comfortable and open to the fact that we get things wrong. So much of what we're doing is sensitizing all of us to the things that we go wrong in, but also mm-hmm. helping to develop a whole community, a whole culture that can help keep each other honest. And that's really, I think, one of the tricks of science as an approach to the world is to embed it with groups of people who all can watch for each other and help each other figure out when we're making these, all these standard mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Standard mistakes, how we fool ourselves. Do you mind if I ask you if you have an example of how you fall into that?
I think one of the most classic examples of this is this concept of confirmation bias. This is where you tend to notice evidence that backs up something you believe, but not notice the evidence that would make you realize that there's something wrong. I remember as a scientist, there's a classic way in which it happens where you tend to really, really hunt for all the things that could be wrong in your experiment until you get the answer that you expect. And then you stop hunting.
Yeah. Okay. So help me out here. If I'm in a conversation, we just went to a holiday party with people in our neighborhood. It's a lot of people who are kind of similar, right? About the same age, about the same level of education. And it can be dangerous because our worldviews are very similar. And we say we're kind of talking about something and a lot of people are nodding their heads. How do I keep in mind there could be confirmation bias going on here?
One of the things that science, I think, has become very good at is getting used to the idea that you actually do want to talk to people who will disagree with you and that you actually go find critics who will not believe what you believe because they're the best people to help you figure out where you're going wrong. And if we want to be, effective in the world, if we want to, choose the right schools, choose the right medicines, things like that, in the end of the day, you really want to know it when you're making a mistake. I think our society has sort of lost touch with this a little bit. We've lost track of the fact that You want to reach out to somebody who would come from a different point of view, not because you're going to try and convince them of something, nor even that necessarily you want them to convince you. But what you want to do is help each other figure out how you could be making mistakes about the world that could make you much more effective if you got that straight.
Yeah. Well, your book has a number of suggestions of tools that we should kind of think about as we go about our lives. And one of them is how we deal with certainty. Because, you know, we love to be sure, we love to say it out loud. But you and your co-authors suggest what you call an opinion budget. You know, maybe not give them out too much. I love that. I've heard about, you know, what writers call the exclamation point budget, where writing teachers said, you get five in your life. Use them sparingly. When you say put yourself on an opinion budget, talk about that.
Our society, and it may be true of some other ones as well, has such a prejudice towards having an opinion. Even in school, we're often taught to write by teaching us, make an argument. And that's obviously a useful for many purposes, but it's not a great way to try to understand the world when generally we don't have enough information. And so generally, you should not have an opinion on most topics, and you should be open to trying to learn more and trying to figure out, you know, where are the balance of the facts coming in. This is also part of this whole topic of being able to deal with the world with a bit of a probabilistic bent, so that you don't say something is definitely true or something's definitely not true. It's very rare that you would know enough to say that. What you can say is that I, you know, have a 60% odds that this is true, or this other thing I'm pretty sure, I think I give it 90% odds. Just having it being a little bit more subtle than yes or no allows you to take in new evidence, to have it change over time. And it's a much more powerful way of dealing with the world than, you know, rounding everything off to either being true or false.
Yeah. Well, it is, as you and your co-authors write, I mean, kind of helping us to think like a scientist. You do write, however.
Although we should comment that we're trying to be careful to make clear that it's not that every scientist is using all these techniques all the time. These are the aspirational goals of what you want to do. And it's not that you have to be a scientist to use these.
Yeah. And we should note, you have a whole section in your book about, you know, science gone wrong, right? We do know that scientists themselves, and as you've said, can be subject to their own cognitive bias or blind spots. Sometimes there are accusations of academic misconduct.
Yeah, absolutely. Scientists themselves are just a bunch of humans like anybody else, and they will do it well and they will do it poorly. What we're saying is that there are a bunch of tools that are really useful, you know, that scientists keep trying to do better and better. They don't always get it right. But then similarly, we all should be able to use them. And that's really the idea here. We also point out that it's not good enough just to have all these tools of rationality by themselves. A lot of the book is about how do you weave it together with all the fears and the goals and the values that shape a decision. And that if you don't come up with a principled way to do that, then you tend to lose the benefits of any of this rationality, because you have to pay attention to the values and the fears and the goals. That's, you know, what drives a decision. So we do spend a lot of time discussing techniques and ideas that people have developed of how to bring those two together.
Yeah. Just briefly, we have a little bit of time left. I want to ask you about why this book now, because you and your co-authors write that particularly in this time, it's important for us to know, develop, and understand, use these tools of critical thinking in this moment.
I would say there are sort of two big reasons why I think this is a real moment that we want these tools available to us. One is that, you know, we are living in a time where people have sort of lost track of how to talk to each other and how to use each other to make progress. And these happen to be a whole set of tools that I think really teach ways to work together. I think if we manage to even get a reasonable fraction of our societies able to talk to each other and start to think about problems as problems that they want to solve together, I would be completely unconcerned about all the big fears of the world right now. One of the things we've learned from science is that we're amazingly able to solve problems when we can stick to them and think about them long enough and be optimistic enough to be able to stick to them and solve them. The other reason I would say that this is such a timely moment for this is that we happen to be at a time where we actually have the ingredients to make a flourishing world out there. So just as it's a scary world, it's also an amazingly hopeful world. We have all the pieces in play. If we could just be on the same page enough to work together a little bit. And so I think that mixture is the reason that we felt that this was such a moment to try to write a book to capture what we were teaching.
Yeah. We've been talking to Nobel Prize-winning physicist Saul Perlmutter. He's the co-author, along with John Campbell and Robert McCohen, of the book Third Millennium Thinking, Creating Sense in a World of Nonsense. Saul Perlmutter, congratulations on the book, and thanks for your time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.